Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is here with news from the Sullivan County Legislature, including a plan to address a dangerous intersection in Wurtsboro. The fight to ban fracking in New York is back. Fracking was first prohibited in the state a decade ago and permanently banned in the 2021 state budget. But a Texas-based company is trying to circumvent the ban by drilling upstate's shales using carbon dioxide instead of water. State lawmakers have introduced legislation that would make that practice illegal. We'll have the latest. New York's annual burn ban starts tomorrow, and we'll hear from the state's DEC commissioner. And our own Classical Kit is here with a preview of the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra's performance this weekend in Narrowsburg and in Monticello. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. An Atlanta judge has ruled that Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis can continue to prosecute former President Donald Trump in his election interference case, but only if lead prosecutor Nathan Wade withdraws from the case. Judge Scott McAfee said the romantic relationship between the two created an appearance of impropriety, but did not amount to a conflict of interest. Wade and Willis say that relationship has ended. A judge will decide whether to delay former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York. Prosecutors say they're open to a delay of up to 30 days. Trump's legal team requested more time to review new records. Jury selection was supposed to start in 10 days. Separately, a judge in Florida denied one of Trump's motions to dismiss charges that he mishandled classified documents. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has approved plans for military action in Rafah in southern Gaza, and evacuations. Meanwhile, Israeli leaders are discussing a new proposal Hamas has presented to release hostages and secure a ceasefire. The war between Israel and Hamas and the situation in Gaza could create tension between President Biden and the Irish Prime Minister when the two leaders meet at the White House today, Willem Marks reports.
The Irish Premier Leo Varadkar and Michelle O'Neill, the new First Minister of Northern Ireland, are among several politicians in Washington, D.C. for an event marking St. Patrick's Day. During an earlier visit to Boston, Varadkar said he would use the opportunity to tell Biden, quote, how the Irish people feel, and to reiterate the desire among many Irish to see, quote, a ceasefire immediately, for the killing to stop, the hostages to be released without condition, food and medicine to get into Gaza. Pacifism is a central tenet of all major parties in the Republic of Ireland, while the country remains militarily neutral and, unlike most of the European Union, has declined to join NATO. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks.
Stocks opened lower this morning as a technology glitch slowed fast food delivery at McDonald's and at McDonald's around the world. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 140 points in early trading.
McDonald's is apologizing for the high-tech outage, which temporarily disabled ordering apps and self-serve kiosks in multiple countries. The company thanked customers for their patience and said it's fixing the problem. The chain says it was not the result of a cyber attack. Industrial production in the U.S. picked up last month, thanks in part to warmer weather. Manufacturing output rose 0.8% in February after a January slump that was partly weather-related. Last month's higher temps depressed demand for heating, though. Utility output fell by 7.5%. And if Congress forces a sale of TikTok, former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin wants to buy it. Mnuchin says he's putting together an investment group, but he offered no details of who else is in it. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Education Department has updated the federal student aid application to address a series of problems. NPR's Janet Wujungli reports.
The U.S. Education Department says that it's made changes to the FAFSA. Now, students whose parents or guardians who don't have a Social Security number should be able to fill out the form. The department, however, also noted that some families and counselors may still run into technical difficulties. They say they're working to find a resolution. Janet Wujungli, NPR News.
In Montana, public health investigators say raw specialty mushrooms poisoned dozens of diners. NPR's Ping Wong reports on how they figured it all out.
Last spring, more than 50 people got sick after eating a sushi roll special at a restaurant in Bozeman, Montana. Three people were hospitalized and two people died. Health officials inspected the restaurant, collected food samples, and interviewed diners. They found the culprit to be raw morel mushrooms, paired with salmon in a special sushi roll. The patients got sick with diarrhea and vomiting about an hour after eating the sushi. These mushrooms can be toxic if they're not adequately cooked. The findings of the investigation are published in the CDC's weekly report. Morel mushrooms have a white stalk and a brownish latticed cap. They have a nutty, earthy taste and are a prized ingredient for high-end chefs. The advice is to always cook your morel mushrooms before eating. Ping Huang, NPR News.
The first major offshore wind farm in the U.S. is now connected to the power grid in New York. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Friday, and that's some music from NPR. We're going to pot that down. Dan Hoost is here with me. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Well, that was quite the introduction.
Well, yeah,
thank you, Tim.
I forgot about that.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! Things are a little off kilter. I don't know if you're aware, but there was a power outage, and we were knocked off air overnight Monday into Tuesday morning. It fried one of our computer's hard drives,
no.
And that hard drive is the one that sort of runs our system. And so we're able to be on air, but it's a different system, a little bit more manual, and so I'm like trying to get my head around it, and so things like that happen. Sorry.
Well, that's when that third hand or third arm comes handy, right? You know, so.
Dan Hoost is the communications director from Sullivan County Government, and he joins us every Friday to help me get through Friday, but also to let you guys know what's going on in Monticello. And thanks for coming in again, of course.
No, my pleasure.
Got some news about some roads and some intersections. There's a kind of a dangerous intersection in Wurtsboro, and the legislature sort of addressed that. Can you give folks the background of what's going on at that intersection?
Yeah, this is the what I call the Wurtsboro Four Corners, but a lot of people would say, oh, it's where the Stewart Shop or Danny's is. It's where Route 209 meets Sullivan Street, which is really actually Old 17. It used to be the way
that curve where there's that right there.
With the... No, it's
a little
the actual
there.
Four Corners.
Oh, right.
Right there in the center of the village of Wurtsboro. It has been a dangerous intersection probably for its entire life. I imagine even if you went back to the horse and buggy days, there was some point when a horse was out of control and ran through that. But I remember reading, I think it was something from the 50s, where there was a horrible fatal accident there with big trucks that are coming down Wurtsboro Mountain Road. Mm-hmm. That would be from the Rock Hill direction. If you're coming from the Bloomingburg direction, you have a long flat area to slow down if your truck's brakes overheat. But on the Wurtsboro Mountain Road, it's basically a hill right down to the intersection. It levels out a little bit, but not too much. And trucks have been having accidents there for decades. However, there were two in February and April of last year that were pretty devastating to the intersection, caused injuries at least to one truck driver. Yesterday, our legislators in their Public Works Committee said we need to urge the DOT to do something about this. We can't change the geography of it. It is what it is. But we need to take a look at how maybe we could reroute some of this heavier truck traffic or create, I didn't even know this existed this way, a traffic signal preemption technology program, I think is what it's called, where it would have sensors buried in the pavement far up the hill that would detect when a heavier weight vehicle is running over speed. And it would then change the signaling down in the intersection to ensure that traffic is not in that intersection when a truck is rolling down that hill. Mm-hmm. So I think probably the DOT has studied this several times. We'll see what they have to say about this. The resolution passed yesterday was simply encouraging them to do something about it. The county has no authority to force any kind of thing or to do anything themselves. These involve the state road, which is – it's actually a federally funded, but it's a state-maintained road, 209, and Sullivan Street, which is the village road there. And, of course, the village and the town of Mamikating as well are very concerned about this. Most likely, I could see them doing a pretty simple change, which would simply be rerouting truck traffic instead of them getting off 17 at 112, that they actually stay on 17, or if they're coming down Old 17, Wurtsboro Mountain Road, that they get on an exit 112, which is the Mountaindale Woodridge exit, and taking 17 down to exit 113, which is the Wurtsboro exit. That puts you on to 209 there, and it's flat right into the village. So, but we'll see.
How does that work when you have these overlapping stakeholders involved? So you've got the county saying, hey, let's do something about this, but they can't really do anything themselves. Mm-hmm. You've got the villages, and then you've got the state. What happens with this resolution, and how long does something like this then take?
Well, we anticipate that the town and the village will also pass their own resolutions, which will then, I think, it, and this one probably on its own will too, will galvanize state officials into at least communicating with the municipalities involved. And I'm not saying they've been incommunicative, but this was the way our legislators felt. It was, they wanted to show the public that they were doing something about it. It's not to say that DOT is being irresponsible or ignoring. That wasn't in the press release, and we're not intimating that. What the county is saying is, let's work on this together and get something done, and then we can all tell the public about it when we finished with it. Let's hold hands on this, not fight with one another.
So some roads that the county can do something about are the county roads, about 33 miles of county roads. What is happening there?
Yeah, it was yesterday, and this is just in committee, so it still has to pass the full legislature next week, but I expect it will, was the routine approval of the year's paving and road work and bridge work projects. And I just wanted to mention that there's a plan to repave at least 33 miles of county roads. At least 37 miles will be surface treated. That's where you get, like, you know, fixing cracks. So you put a little layer of pavement over the existing pavement. A repaving would be ripping up the old pavement and replacing it. And then restriping about 75 miles of road, which we have to do every year because snow plows are tough on that paint. They actually literally scrape it up, as do our tires as we're traveling along on those roads. So this is just something I like to tell the public about, because this is where you can really see your taxes at work. Are the roads being fixed? And let's face it, in a county like this, we all use those roads. There is very few people who get to just walk to work. Most of us, even if we're on bikes, have to be using the roadways, and we want them to be as in good shape as possible.
And, you know, certainly we're seeing some of those roads in their condition after the winter. There's a season for this, obviously. You can't do much in the winter. When does that sort of start for the folks that repave the county roads? Is that
Really when the blacktop plants start up, which I'm told is going to be around March 30th this year. So April will really be when that season gets going, because, of course, we're not the only ones lining up at the blacktop plant to get the asphalt. But it really is dependent upon when those plants are operating, and really at full capacity. So I'm sure it takes a short amount of time for them to ramp up operations. But as soon as those are going, that's when we'll start this program. So I expect April.
Robins building nests, the roofs being repaved, the sign of spring. All right. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Dan Hoost. He is the communications director for Sullivan County Government. Joins us every Friday for an update from the Sullivan County Legislature. There's a camp vaccination resolution. I guess there's going to be further discussion about this, but what is this camp vaccination resolution all about?
This is something the county has done in the past, although I think there are tweaks to it now. And so there's been some discussion between camps as to, does this go too far? Is it necessary? It was discussed a little bit in legislature yesterday about requiring vaccinations, not only for all the children in our camps in the area. And this is secular and religious camps. This is not discriminating against any particular group, but also the staff needing to be vaccinated. And that's where it has gotten controversial. Our public health team is saying, listen, this is a congregate setting. The kids are in rooms sleeping together and spending long amounts of time during the day together. The staff usually are housed in dormitory style bunks where they'll be sleeping together. And they're also spending a lot of time with them, with each other, and with the kids as well. However, there are some legislators also who are feeling like, oh, well, maybe we don't need to go that far with it. And there's a substantive discussion going on. So there was no resolution reached yesterday about how far to take the vaccination order. It's going to be discussed again this Thursday between executive and full board. So I believe at 9:30 a.m. they're going to bring it up again. And it's really something interesting to tune into, because you will hear compelling arguments on both sides, which is, you need to have people who are vaccinated. But if it's already hard to find staff, and there are people who have issues with being vaccinated on certain things, can you hire them? Can you not? What does this law go too far? Is it good where it is? And I have my personal opinions on it. Probably everybody who listens to this has their own opinions on it. But this is about figuring out a way to move forward with this, where the camps can be in compliance with our public health order, which a lot of people think, oh, the public health department is the one that makes this into being an official law. No, it's the legislature. The legislature actually has that authority. It's a public health authority. A lot of people don't realize that. So the legislature has to make this decision as to how far they're going to go with vaccination requirements for camps. And I encourage people to tune into this conversation, because it will be an interesting one. And you will find out, I hope, at that point, what direction the legislature decides to go in.
Is there any regulation or guidance at the state level when it comes to children's camps?
Yeah. The state, if I understand correctly, leaves a lot of the vaccination stuff to the local health departments, because they're the ones that can provide the vaccinations. The state does the inspections, however. And of course, if there was any kind of outbreak, the state would come in and help the local public health department control and maintain, or even if they have to shut down the camp to do that. However, this is something that New York State is a home rule state on. So the local authority to mandate this actually rests with the counties. Some counties do mandate this, other counties do not.
There's not a resolution currently. So what?
No, there's a resolution currently. It's it'd be public health order number one. It just not has not. And it's available to see online. It just has not been voted upon yet.
I'm sorry. I meant that there's no regulation or guidance currently. So what?
Well, there's guidance from the state. I mean,
let me clarify again.
Okay.
So there's nothing on the books that tells a camp what it needs to do when it comes to vaccinations at this point from the county level.
Not to that level.
Right. So right. There's a resolution that might address that, right? So what prompted this resolution? Why now?
It's every year in time for camp season, so that camp operators know what they have to comply with. Last year, this resolution did not ultimately come to a vote, but the year before, and I think several years before that, this resolution has been passed by the legislature. So we're in an area right now of uncertainty. Are they going to? Are they not going to? And that's where I encourage people to tune in on Thursday to see what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, we've certainly seen some of the stories out of Florida about the measles outbreak and such, and not about a camp per se, but it does involve vaccines.
Our public health team is very concerned about it, and I understand why.
Dan Hoost is Sullivan County Communications Director. We're going to have more with him after a break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from the Calicoon Farmers Market, indoors this winter at the Delaware Youth Center, serving local needs every Sunday. More information at calicoonfarmersmarket.org.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, joining us every Friday for an update on what's going on in Monticello with the county legislature. We're talking also about a naturalization ceremony, which is coming up on Wednesday.
Yeah, this is really exciting, and I stream this live. If I can get myself there in time and set everything up, I may stream the entire event live because people love watching this. It's some of our best watched videos. I stream the part where they take their oath of citizenship. We usually have between 10 and 20 new American citizens who have gone through the very labor intensive, time intensive. I'm not sure what the cost is, but I'm sure there's a cost to it, of becoming a naturalized citizen of the United States of America. They come from all over. Some of them have been here for a while on work visas. Others are fairly new to the area, but they're all different. They're all different shapes, colors, and sizes, reflecting the world that we live in. And I love it. It's one of my favorite things to go document. And I want to share that with the public because people really enjoy seeing that, where a lot of times we're talking about immigration and the border, and it's a very polarizing conversation. This is one everyone can rally around. These are folks who said, I want to be part of the United States for all sorts of very fascinating reasons. And they have worked hard through the process that exists now to become citizens. And this is the end result of it. This is that final joyful exultation. I did it. I made it. And their family is there. Our county clerk, Russell Reeves, and his team get to do the swearing in. We usually have a local judge that makes some sort of comments about what it means to be an American citizen. We usually learn about their lives and how their families came to America. So it's just one of those things that makes you really feel really good about living where you live.
And one of those things about being a citizen is the privilege of being able to vote, cast yes. your vote. It is a big election year, mm-hmm. and so we want to remind folks about early voting and coming around sooner than I recall, remember. I guess I don't have a firm grasp on what the calendar is, but that's starting next Saturday.
Yes, it is. A week from tomorrow, March 23rd, it begins and runs every day through March 30th. Each day could be a different time, but each day will be at the same locations, the Government Center in Monticello and our public health, or what I call our Olmsted or Gladys Olmsted building on our community services campus, our social services campus in Liberty. And we encourage registered Democrats and registered Republicans to come out and vote. This primary is for them. On both sides, it isn't just for the presidential candidate. There's, I think on the Democratic side, there's some committee, or not committee people, delegates, I think, to the convention that they're to vote for. So we hope people come out. We've spent a lot of time putting this together, and we really want to see those folks turn up. And also, when you're there, maybe say a little thank you to the inspectors for doing the work they do, because they're there for a long time. If you don't or can't make it to the early voting, then the actual primary, I believe, is on the 2nd of April, and all the normal polling stations in Sullivan County will be open. For more information, sullivanny.us/departments/elections, or just look up Sullivan County Board of Elections.
And as a reminder, this is for the April 3rd presidential primary in New York.
Did I say 2nd and you said 3rd?
Is it the 2nd or 3rd? Hold on.
Wait a minute. Let's make sure. Because you're saying again, the third. I thought it was the second.
I don't have grasp of the calendar. So, but I guess my point is this is for the presidential primary. It's yes. not for any of the other elected
no, that's in June.
Races
the,
that are happening. So just
the rest
to be
of the
clear,
primaries
this is,
will be coming in June.
That, in New York, but in Pennsylvania, their primary, which is coming up, involves a lot of other stuff as well. So for yes. New York, we're talking about that.
Yeah, we're just talking about New York. I just have, thankfully, the Sullivan County part to talk about. So, but while you... While you're looking
April
that up,
2nd.
It is April 2nd. Sorry. Wow, that was fast. Okay.
No, it's the right. 2nd. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make sure. April 2nd. Shoo. So I want to also mention, too, I didn't have this on my list, but I just found out notice of this last night. The emergency HEAP benefit, which is our home energy assistance program, meaning that you've already gotten the original HEAP benefit, but now you're close to running out of fuel, or you have run out of fuel, or your electric's about to be turned off because you couldn't afford to pay. A new second emergency HEAP benefit opened up last night. You can apply for it today.
Yeah, and one other thing about the presidential election on April 2nd, the primary on April 2nd in New York, there are going to be some candidates still on the ballot that dropped out of the race because in New York, and according to the New York State Board of Elections, suspending a campaign does not automatically remove someone's name from the ballot. Mm-hmm. So you'll see that on both sides, some names that you may have forgotten about who may have dropped out from the race officially. And then also, as you mentioned, there are some candidates for delegates for the Democratic National Convention, and the delegates vary depending on which congressional district that you're in. So hopefully it didn't muddle the election process.
Well, you can find out from our Board of Elections site or just call them 807-0400, 845-807-0400. They'd be happy to answer any question.
All right. The county offering an automotive technician course free for up to 15 local residents. This is a continuation of some training that the county has been offering for specific trades. I think there was one for electricians.
We had construction trades last year and then welding later in the year.
Yeah.
I think that's the rhythm we're getting into now is twice a year we're going to offer these, hopefully in different fields as we go along, but we're working with Sullivan Bosse's on this, so it has to be something they're able to train. But we also want it to be very vocational skills, not something that you necessarily need to have a four-year degree for, but you definitely need to be trained and certified. And I'm excited to mention that this automotive technician trades course is coming with ASE certification. I still don't know what that – I should have looked that up, what ASE stands for. I'm sure you will, Tim.
Hopefully.
But yeah. It's automotive something, but it's the kind I've seen the logo for ASC certification before, and it means they really have to hit certain standards.
Automotive Service Excellence.
Okay. I keep wanting to say Automotive Society of Engineers, but it's Automotive Service Excellence. And this is training for up to 15 local residents that the county pays for. They don't have to pay for it. And that includes the tuition, the books, the materials, anything with that. We cover the cost, because we want to get people into the workforce who might have otherwise felt like this isn't something I can do or afford. And we've had those stories time and again now with people who said, if it weren't for this program, I wouldn't have been able to learn these skills. And with these skills, they get into living wage jobs. This is not something where you're making minimum wage. Employers are eager to hire people at competitive wages for these kinds of skills. So I'm really excited. We're starting this April 9th. So if you're interested or know somebody who may be interested, they need to apply now to our Center for Workforce Development, which you can give them a call at 845-794-3340. I'll repeat that, 845-794-3340. Give them a call right away. They will make sure that you get an application because it's going to be selective. Last time, I think we had only 10 seats and we had over 60 applicants. So now that shouldn't discourage anyone. We want more applicants because then we can cull from that the people who truly meet all the eligibility guidelines and are most in need of being able to have this kind of course. But, and listen, if you don't necessarily make the cut on this one, we're probably going to be offering this again because these programs have become very popular.
Well, certainly a need for automotive technicians on that type of area. Are there specific age requirements? Is this meant for folks 18 plus?
You have to be 18 plus. You have to have a valid driver's license and reliable transportation. You have to be willing, ready, and able to work. Once you complete it, we don't want to hear people like with the construction trades. We had people like, oh, I just want to become a do-it-yourselfer. That's not what this is for. No, we want you to contribute to this workforce, to become a part of it here in Sullivan County. And of course, the other big requirement, you have to be a county resident. You don't have to be one for very long, but you have to be a county resident.
How long is the course?
The course will run 8 weeks every Tuesday and Thursday from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Sullivan County BOCES here in Liberty at the Reuben Pollock Education Center. They already teach the automotive trades to teenagers, and they are perfectly set up to train adults as well. So as long as you're 18 and over, come on and apply.
They have a nice setup, too.
Yes, they do.
And the all of this covered costs all covered by the county.
By the taxpayers of the county, who I think get a return on this investment many times over.
And the county directory is on the website. This is the updated 2024 directory.
Yeah, this is Sullivan County's version of the Bible, which is certainly something I use a lot because it has names, numbers, even email addresses for all the officials in Sullivan County, from the federal level right on down to the town and village level. You want to know who your federal representative is and how to get in touch with them? This has it. You want to know who your legislator is, how to get in touch with them? This has it. You need to know the number for the Center for Workforce Development or Office for the Aging or the town of Coshecton or the Village of Liberty. This has that information as current as we possibly can make it. Currently in digital form on our website. I expect in the next week or two, we will have these little booklets that are come in a different color every year that will become one of the most coveted items. And we will start handing them out and spreading them all over the place.
All right. Also, I just want to say thank you to the Sullivan County Legislature. I was invited to make a presentation about the station yesterday, along with Mimi Bradley, our development manager. And we were welcomed and were able to give an update on what we're working on here and show some of the faces behind the radio. And so thank you. It was a little, I would have to say I was a little nervous. Part of my job is to speak on the radio, but I'm in a room by myself.
Right.
This was like walking into one of those, you know, those Star Wars movies you walk into, like there's a council and there's like a spotlight on that one person. I kind of felt like that for a minute, but everyone was very friendly and nice. And it was nice to see folks. And we also heard from some members of the public unsolicited who came up and said thank you for the station as well in front of folks too. So that was nice to be there. So I got a warm feeling from the legislature. I don't know how often you hear that.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that you brought this up. I was hoping you would because you really did, I think, make a very positive impact on the legislature. They need to hear about what organizations in the community are doing. And they also, of course, you know, fund organizations like JFF. They need to see what that money is going to be used for and how it really is reinvested in the Sullivan County community. JFF is one of several really great organizations, nonprofits that we have in the community that I think rely upon the community really truly understanding who and what they are and how you provide what you provide. We certainly in county government rely on our partnership with you to make sure that people get the information they need to know. And I certainly can say here, I very much appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you coming in. And again, thanks for having us there. The Delaware Valley Arts Alliance was there giving a report right after us. And so it was also good to see like other members of the community that we have partnerships with and seeing how they're what they're doing. I mean, kind of have an idea of it, but when you see it up on the screen and on paper and charts, and I'm kind of jealous of Ariel Schanberg's presentation, I have to say. Like lots of charts, very slick.
Yeah, yours was very good too, though. And it was important for legislators to see what these organizations are doing, because sometimes we all get caught up in the daily grind of the government or in the politics of the moment. This is about, hey, what's happening in our communities? Yeah. People are doing really good things.
Yep. Thank you. And also, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
To you as well, and to everyone who's listening, Irish or not.
All right. Dan, who's the communications director for Sullivan County Government, he joins us every Friday. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, there is a fight again about fracking in New York. We'll tell you more after this break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Nearly a decade after New York passed its controversial fracking ban, the debate over resource extraction in the state has returned. A Texas-based company's proposal to use carbon dioxide to extract oil and gas gets around the state's hydraulic fracking ban. From the New York Public News Network, WSKG's Rebecca Redelmeyer has more on the reaction from landowners and legislators and how this moment echoes the state's previous fracking fight.
There's a bit of deja vu watching a crowd rally against fracking at New York State Capitol. At the front of the demonstration earlier this month, State Senator Leah Webb leads the group in a chant they know well. Webb, who represents part of the Southern Tier, is one of many elected officials, environmentalists, and advocates who have made this demand before, years ago, before New York banned hydraulic fracking. After that, most thought the fight was over. They had won. As oil and gas companies began fracking in neighboring Pennsylvania and other states, New York remained untouched. But now there's a new proposal to frack here, one that skirts the ban and has revived this decades-old fight.
This is an opportunity that I believe that the Southern Tier has.
That's Bryce Phillips, the president of Southern Tier Solutions, the Texas-based company behind the new proposal. The idea is to extract gas using carbon dioxide rather than water, getting around the state's hydraulic fracking ban and promising to dispose of tens of millions of metric tons of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the process. Phillips declined multiple requests to interview with WSKG, but he explained the plan on public radio's Capitol Press Room last year. He has framed it as an innovative and environmentally friendly way to extract gas.
If you want to reach the goals of the 2019 Climate Act, you would allow us to capture carbon dioxide from existing power plants in Pennsylvania and pipe that carbon dioxide to the Southern Tier and inject it.
It's a controversial proposal. Many experts say carbon sequestration is not a scalable solution to capturing greenhouse gases and distracts from efforts to transition away from fossil fuels. Leaking carbon can also contaminate groundwater and threaten human health. Alex Beecham is the Northeast Region Director at Food and Water Watch. He says those concerns add to the host of health and environmental risks that got the state to ban fracking in the first place, like contaminated drinking water and increased emissions.
The reason we banned fracking wasn't only that the drilling process is dangerous, and it is, but it's because we have to keep that gas in the ground.
Webb and other New York legislators introduced a bill earlier this year that would expand the fracking ban to prohibit using carbon dioxide to extract gas. They say there's no way to safely use carbon dioxide for fracking, and that the proposal contradicts the state's own emission reduction commitments. If the bill passes, the Southern Tier Solutions plan would be over. But for now, the company hopes to continue to attract landowners along the Marcellus and Utica shales to lease their land. At the end of last year, it sent out information to over 6,000 landowners in the region. Bob Sullivan got one of those mailers. He owns a horse farm in Binghamton and other land in the area. He's been considering signing a lease.
But I'm likely to go ahead with it. I mean, if I were to have to decide today, I would go ahead with it.
He hopes to one day be able to profit off the resources under his land, just as he hoped over a decade ago when the original fracking fight began. But in New York, he has some doubts over whether the new fracking proposal will ever get off the ground.
There's no question that this natural gas is down there. The question is, how hard is the state going to fight industry and the landowners to prevent it from happening?
The bill to ban the practice now awaits a vote on both the Assembly and Senate floors. In Ithaca, I'm Rebecca Redelmeyer for the New York Public News Network.
And we'll take a break. When we come back, the DEC is reminding New Yorkers that the annual residential burn ban starts tomorrow. The spring burn ban reduces wildfire risks and protects lives and property. We'll hear from New York's DEC commissioner right after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Saturday at noon, I bring you 2 hours of the very best of the current jazz scene, along with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. It's wonderful music that will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, only on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, Jackson was bitten by a spider, a black widow, very poisonous. And he knew about spiders, knew he needed medical attention, but didn't do anything.
So I'm fishing while I'm mulling this over.
Wait, you started fishing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm there. There's the water. There's the net.
People who have not caught up to the reality that they're living in. That's this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. With spring comes an increased risk of wildfires. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Lucas Willard reports New York State will begin enforcing its annual burn ban tomorrow. Violators of the state's open burning regulation are subject to criminal and civil enforcement actions.
Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Basil Sagos. I'm the
New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Basil Sagos appeared at the Albany Pine Bush Preserve to ask state residents to be aware of the state's annual burn ban. The ban, which runs Saturday through May 14th, restricts residents from open burning. Sagos said while some fires are allowed, such as small cooking fires or barbecue grilling, he wants New Yorkers to act responsibly.
Be smart about fires, right? Be smart about backyard fires. Be smart about your campfires. Also, if you smoke, maybe think twice about throwing a butt into the grass this time of year as well. Just a common sense precaution.
Sagos, joined by DEC forest rangers, spoke under a clear blue sky with a light breeze surrounded by dry grass.
You can see, there's lots of dry brush everywhere. And the extent the sun's blowing on it, and we get shining on it, we get some wind blowing in through it as well. I mean, that is the right conditions for some fires to spread.
It was a mild, drier winter with a lack of snow across much of New York. And DEC Forest Ranger Captain Scott Jackson said the agency has already responded to several fires.
Rangers have responded to 9 fires so far this year, and it was a total of around a little over 70 acres. And I know the local fire departments have responded to many more beyond that.
The Albany Pine Bush Preserve itself is a unique ecosystem. Staff at the Preserve Commission use prescribed burns to not only manage habitat, but also to reduce the risk of an out-of-control fire in an area surrounded by suburban homes. Neil Gifford is the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission's conservation director.
One of the many reasons why we use prescribed fire here is to reduce wildfire risk. It's all about keeping the fuel loads low. But yeah, when you have low winds like this and this time of year before things green up, the grasses and leaf litter are very dry and easily ignite.
In fact, conditions allowed staff at the preserve to conduct their earliest prescribed burn ever in February. Commissioner Sagos reminded New Yorkers that burn ban violators can face consequences.
This ban is enforceable. It's enforceable by law enforcement. Certainly $500 for the first offense, and our teams, DEC teams, will be patrolling the state looking for fires over the next few weeks.
For WAMC News, I'm Lucas Willard.
We'll take a quick break. When we come back, the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra is performing Sunday and Monday. Classical Kit speaks with Andrew Trombley. After a break, this is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Grizzly Bagels, small batch, handmade New York style bagels in Calicoon, New York. Available for pre-order or in-person pickup. GrizzlyBagels.com.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman said he doesn't care that Miami Beach has canceled spring break.
I'm sorry, Peter. I'm a grown-up. I get drunk during the week whenever I want.
I'm Peter Sagal. Celebrate however you like as you listen to this week's show with David Alan Greer and special guest sidekick Andy Richter. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra is performing a free concert titled The Evolution of the Double Bass in Narrowsburg Sunday at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, and then again in Monticello on Monday at St. John's Episcopal Church. Our own Classical Kit spoke to Andrew Trombley from the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra.
Morning, Andrew. Thanks so much for taking this time from your very busy schedule
to talk with us this morning.
I'm always happy to make time. I appreciate you guys, you know, covering the SECO concerts that we have.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. Before we get started, I think congratulations are in order because I believe you became a dad since the last time I spoke with you.
I have. She's just over 2 months old now, our very first daughter. She's wonderful.
Great.
I struggled to find time to practice, but, you know, it's a joy. I'm happy to have.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you so much.
So you're performing, you're teaching, and you're still committing a lot of time to just bringing extraordinary performances to this little corner of the Catskills with the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra. And you've got several concerts on your spring schedule. So I was wondering if you could tell us about the first concert of the season, Evolution of the Double Bass.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. When I was in school, I performed recitals regularly because most people associate the double bass with, you know, always being on the low end, whether it's basso continuo or you're simply doing your 1-5-1-5. But it's really quite an extraordinary instrument that has a remarkable singing voice. And in a lot of ways, the double bass has actually been in existence longer in its current form than any other instrument that we have. For instance, you know, back in down in Australia, it's owned by the Australian Chamber Orchestra. There is an amazing instrument made by the maker Gasparo da Salo, which is built in the year 1580, I believe.
Wow.
So the iteration of this instrument has been around for such a long time, but because it's never quite gotten the attention of many composers or composers would struggle to write for it. I think there's a rumor that Brahms may have composed a concerto for the bass, but he hated the score so much that he burned it. But so because of that, bass players have taken on themselves to create transcriptions for the instrument to try and showcase the remarkable talents that, you know, this instrument has to offer.
I love it because just the resonance of it, you can kind of feel it in your body when you go to a live concert, which is just incredible. And I know that some composers have, composed for the instrument. It's always tricky if you're playing those things on the radio because there's so much energy in those low notes that it looks like your meters are going into the red when it's really not too loud. It's just the energy of it. So you're going to be playing a really interesting program. I confess, I really was not familiar with Giovanni Pergolesi.
Pergolesi.
And tell us about that sinfonia. Was that a piece that was composed for cello or orchestra?
There's two reasons why I really want to choose that. One, it's a brilliant short, about a 7-minute composition. And yes, Pergolesi did write that for cello. But when Stravinsky wrote his very famous ballet, the Pulcinella Suite, he was adapting all the music he discovered of Pergolesi to create a score. And there is a very famous bass and trombone duet, the Vivo, which uses the last movement of the sinfonia. And it's almost a direct copy, note for note, of that music to the Stravinsky. Also, as well, which makes this kind of fun, when I was trying to find some performances online for study, trombone players also regularly perform a transcription of that same Pergolesi.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I'm familiar with that Stravinsky, but I didn't know the source. So that'll be, are you going to open with that?
Yes, I will be opening with then I'll be moving on to the Lee Hoiby three songs. And that's to showcase much more of the lyrical qualities that this instrument has to offer. I had a chance to perform these pieces with Lee in one of his last public performances before he passed. And, you know, he was such an inspiring person in the way that these three particular songs, I think, have also gone through various arrangements because Lee loved to share his music with as many of his friends, his talented friends, as possible. I believe he originally arranged these three songs for a friend of his who was also a bass player, but then passed the score along to me after I performed publicly. He was at a kind of like a party soiree type thing. He was there and he was so impressed with the performance. He gave me these three songs. And then I've been working with Mark to try and get a sense of how much chamber music Lee has actually composed. You know, on his website, He has a fair number of chamber compositions that he has composed. But then I'm realizing within his partner's Mark's library, there are so many more scores that just haven't really made it either to the publisher or to the light of day, just because Lee would constantly rearrange and rearrange and rearrange. One of the things I'm looking forward to, if I can skip ahead to June in this season, is Lee wrote a beautiful set of theme and variations on a theme by Schubert for piano, and he arranged that for a nonet, which from what I understand, that has not been performed yet, and we will be performing that this June.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I saw, you know, that the finale concert for your spring season was the Grand Nonet, and I was wondering what that was about. So now you've given us a sneak preview, but I will say I'm hoping that we can get you back on Radio Chatskill before June to talk some more about that concert. So you're going to be doing, you're going to be opening with the Pergolesi, and then you're going to do Lee's songs. And then you're going to do a piece that it's really requires a lot of energy. That cello sonata of Beethoven's is, I think the first movement is, I don't know, it's like 18 minutes or something. I mean, it's...
it depends on how you look at the first movement, because there is the slow introduction and then there is the very fast allegro. So, yeah, collectively, it's probably about 18 minutes. So I was discussing with my accompanist, do we consider this a two-movement work? Do we consider this a three-movement work? You know, how do you decide to go about that? But it is a long piece of music, and this has a little bit of historical context as well, because while I did mention that the bass has not had a lot of the attention that it needs from composers, that's not to say that we were without our great virtuosos, our Paganinis, our Mozarts. And one of the greatest bass players of the 18th century was Domenico Dragonetti, born and raised in Venice. And he eventually moved over to London, where he made a remarkable career, basically as a freelancing orchestral player and composer. And it was in London where he actually met Beethoven. And he composed this, or he performed this sonata with Beethoven at the piano. And after the run, Beethoven was so impressed and so in love with Dragonetti that he jumped up and threw his arms around Dragonetti and his instrument in just so much excitement. And because of that relationship, that is why once you start getting towards Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and onwards, the bass parts become incredibly more complex and difficult, because he was aware of the abilities that bass players or the instrument could have.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. That's great. You know, because so often your instrument is playing transcriptions of things that were written for cello, but to know that the composer himself, you know, experienced that is really terrific.
Absolutely.
So you also have a concert coming up April 7th, a Sunday Tea Time concert. And
yes, we do.
Can you give us an idea what you might be thinking about playing for that?
Of course. This is going to be, we have a brilliant pianist we're bringing back, Roting Lee. She's joined us before, and exactly this time last year, she performed on the Salon series. And we, now that we're more aware of where the great pianos are within Sullivan County, we personally at Ness and Cole Gillard have a fantastic Steinway that's being housed at St. John's Episcopal Church. But also the Gloria Kratz Recital Hall is a great space for piano chamber music.
Right.
Any opportunities that we can to do that. And so for this program, one that is inspiring me is the Glinka Grand Sextet.
Mm.
And this is something that he composed when he was living in Russia. Glinka was a very sickly man, and his doctor prescribed him that he needed to go leave Russia and spend some time in Italy just to enjoy the sun. I wish my doctor would give me that prescription, but
yeah.
And unfortunately it doesn't work as easily now, I guess. But he did spend a lot of time there, and when he was there, he was just totally absorbed into the operatic style of Italy, going to La Scala on almost a nightly basis. And he was also completely infatuated with the daughter of his doctor there, who is a brilliant amateur pianist. Unfortunately, he was married, so he wasn't able to return his feelings, but he was still inspired with his talent. So with her talent, so he composed this Grand Sextet, which is in a lot of essence, essentially a piano concerto for five strings, with five strings. And it's got a lot of that absolutely brilliant virtuoso writing. And then one of the things that we love about being able to create these programs is that, you know, my wife and I, we like to have a chamber music bucket list. And one thing that's on the bucket list has always been the Dvorak number 2. That's one of the most iconic iterations of the piano quintet within the Romantic repertoire, that every player that I have known personally has always put that on their top tiers of must need to play pieces. And so that's why we want to really showcase the two of them together. It's because they're both music that's just built out of passion, and that's something that we like to share as much as possible. So that will be, then that program will just be those two pieces, because that's a lot of notes for our pianists as well.
Lovely. So your concert that's coming up, the first one, you're going to be doing two performances. The first at the Gloria Grauss Recital Hall in at the DVAA. And then the next evening you'll be at St. John's Episcopal Church. So two performances with great pianos, which is wonderful. And I neglected to mention the pianist.
Daniel Colalio. He's become a very good friend of mine, another brilliant pianist who has been performing with everyone across New York City that I know. And it was a little bit serendipitous, because when I actually called him and he says, not only am I available, I have just performed this bass already with a cellist. So it's already within my repertoire. So it kind of worked out perfectly to bring him in for this one.
That's
he joined
great.
Us last December when we had our Nutcracker dance party, and he was the pianist that covered all of the harp parts.
Oh, that's lovely. So it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate. One thing I do have to ask, just for my personal curiosity before I let you go, is, of course, last night was Oscar night, so I've had movies on my mind. And last time we spoke, we talked a little bit about the fact that you've played for a lot of soundtracks, but usually you're doing that in a studio. And I would like to know what it was like to play in Carnegie Hall for Maestro.
That was a long day, quite the experience. A couple of things that come to mind is going down for the fittings of very period costumes. And I just remember how much hair product that they used to get me on camera that day. You know, that being in the 1940s, it was a lot of hair product. And I think they used an entire can of hairspray on me alone. But it was quite an experience. You know, you see all these people who are working as extras. And because we actually did perform, you know, I don't know if they used the actual sound, but every musician on that stage was a certified trained musician. And we did perform the music of Manfred with Bradley Cooper conducting. So we were a little bit more, qualified than your typical extra, but the amount of work that extras go through, it's really quite extraordinary. And that really adds so much to, I think, the scenery of the music. We did do a fair bit extra than just the 5 minutes. I haven't finished the film yet. I'm about halfway through, you know, with my daughter. It's a little bit tricky to finish movies sometimes. But I did see my scene within the first 5 minutes, and we did film a fair bit extra. So I'm hoping within the deleted scenes, you might be able to see more. But it was an amazing experience. You know, Bradley was an incredible director to watch. You know, he has such an eye for detail. And one thing I absolutely loved about that movie was the cinematography behind everything. Using the film that he selected that was era appropriate. And when I watched that scene where he was conducting the Mahler Second, that looked almost shot for shot like the original video of Leonard Bernstein conducting. It was really kind of incredible how he captured the essence of the era with Bernstein.
Well, I'm glad you got to have that experience. It sounded like an additional thing to add to your list of wonderful experiences of teaching and performing for opera, performing for symphony, for chamber music, and for film. So that's great, and you'll have stories to tell your little girl when she grows up about your movies. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. And I'm really looking forward to your spring season and to getting you back here again. And I have to say, I'm hoping at some point we'll get you here in our studio with an instrument or two.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I know we would absolutely love to do that.
Well, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kit.
All right, that's Kit Hewlett, classical Kit, speaking to Andrew Trombley from the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra. Their concert's coming up Sunday and Monday. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. On air at 90.5 FM. Streaming online at WJFFradio.org. We are Radio Catskill.